Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We are podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show whenever you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can subscribe to the show on iTunes. Later on in the program, we're going to be speaking to chef and author Deborah Madison. Right now, I'd like to welcome Professor Robert Legbold. He is Professor Emeritus at Columbia University and Project Director at the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, and he will be speaking in Santa Fe this Saturday, March 14th, from 3 to 5, at the Forum at the College of Santa Fe on Russia's new international posture, and this is sponsored by the Santa Fe Council on International Relations. Welcome, Professor Legbold.
It's nice to be with you.
So, your specialty is Russia. Can you give us an overview of United States-Russia relations since the end of the Soviet Union? How did things change when the enmity of the Cold War was over?
Well, they've been up and down, dramatically up and down, coming out of the Cold War after a period when the Reagan and Bush administrations had cooperated with the Soviet Union of Gorbachev to end the Cold War. And Boris Yeltsin, as the new Russian leader, took over. There was a period of real friendship and cooperation, even talk of Russia more or less joining the West, maybe even coming into an organization like NATO. But by the mid-1990s, around a series of events, including NATO enlargement, when Russia was not going to be included, and growing concern on Russia's part about the interaction between Russia, the United States, and NATO in the former Soviet Union, the post-Soviet space, relations began going downhill. They improved briefly after 9/11 in the most recent Bush administrations, only to sink again after the United States invaded Iraq during the 2003 war. And they've been downhill since 2005 and precipitously, almost in free fall, since the war in Georgia, the former Soviet republic, in August of this year.
Tell us more about the significance of NATO. I mean, originally, NATO was kind of an anti-Russian or anti-Soviet Union organization, was it not?
NATO was the major allied military form by which the United States and its European powers defended themselves against what they saw as a military threat posed by the Soviet Union within Europe. Its primary function, in fact, its exclusive function, was to defend our NATO partners in Europe against Russia in Europe, Russia with its alliance system, the so-called Warsaw Pact. But when the Cold War, in the context of the ending of the Cold War, the Soviet Union collapsed and that alliance system, the Warsaw Pact, disintegrated, NATO didn't do the same. NATO continued for several good reasons. One, because NATO had transformed the nature of military relations among West European countries. Remember, historically, Germans and French had been more often enemies than they'd been friends, at least on the eve of wars. And the NATO organization had created a new kind of relationship within Western Europe. Plus, NATO was given new missions. It was to be a principal form of cooperation by which we dealt with issues of instability in Europe, such as that which arose when Yugoslavia came apart and the Balkans began to go up in flames in the 1990s. And we tried to persuade the Russians that as NATO was enlarging, it also was a different NATO, a NATO with a different mission. But the Russians were never persuaded. We tried a couple of arrangements by which Russia could cooperate with NATO without being in NATO, and that was never satisfactory from the Russian point of view. So NATO lingers. It now has an important role in Afghanistan, for example, where during the Cold War, it didn't take on what are called out-of-area responsibilities. But Afghanistan is clearly an out-of-area responsibility.
How does NATO actually function? What does it do? What do its people do?
It's an alliance now of 27 countries because NATO has been enlarged to include some of those former allies of the Soviet Union that were in the Warsaw Pact, and we've gone through several rounds of enlargement. At first, in the 1990s, in 1997, meant that we included the Hungarians, the Czechs from the Czech Republic, and the Poles. And since then, we've expanded to include the three Baltic republics and countries to the south. So now it's a larger organization than it was originally. It was basically 19 countries with the United States and Canada, important transatlantic allies, but principally West European countries that didn't include some of the neutrals like Switzerland and Sweden. And as I say, its primary role was what's called a mutual security assistance. That is, the basic principle was an attack on any one country would be an attack on all, and they would collect their efforts in order to repulse it or deal with it. And that was primarily in terms of a Cold War where a named enemy existed, which was the Soviet Union and its alliance system. So these days, as I've said, it has an enlarged membership all the way up to the Russian border, up to the Ukrainian border, up to the Belarusian border, and it is performing functions in the Balkans and in Afghanistan.
President Obama recently sent a letter to the Russian president offering to basically shelve the missile defense plan that was going to be in place in exchange for Russia's help in preventing Iran from developing nuclear weapons. What's the nature of the relationship between Russia and Iran that they can help with this?
Russia has a very complex relationship with Iran. I think the Russian leadership is not pleased at the prospect of Iran acquiring nuclear weapons. I think they're opposed to that. But because they have a complex relationship that has many sides, after all, the U.S. relationship with Iran is really confined to three issues, that of nuclear weapons, what we see as the Iranian role in promoting terrorism, because we continue to call groups like Hezbollah in the Middle East a terrorist group, and third, in the obstructionism on Iran's part to a Middle East settlement. Those are our three issues. But for Russia, the relationship with Iran, beyond the question of Iran's nuclear aspirations, include how oil and gas gets developed in the Caspian Sea region, because Iran, like Russia and others, literal states, that is, those on the borders of the Caspian Sea, have claims in that area. Russia's interested in selling arms to Iran as Iran modernizes its military forces. Russia's interested, its major gas company and some of its oil companies interested in participating in the oil and gas fields in Iran. Iran is one of the countries with the world's largest gas reserves. Russia is a country that has the largest gas reserves, but they want to participate in others. Russia has a stake in Iran in terms of how Iran approaches the question of Islam, particularly the Shia populations in Central Asia and in the North Caucasus. Which form a part of Russia and an important part of Russia's immediate southern neighbors. So there are many dimensions to the Russian relationship with Iran, and they try to balance those elements, those positive elements where they have a stake that they'd like to preserve, while at the same time trying to find a way by which the Iranians can be diverted from or discouraged from actually going forward with uranium enrichment and the building of a nuclear weapon.
So what do you think of this idea of tying the trying to get rid of or reduce missile defense systems with this Iranian connection?
It's a logical connection. I call it a logical connection because they're linked on the part of the United States. Our basic position is that those ballistic missile components that are to be placed in or to be deployed in Poland and the Czech Republic, the missile battery in Poland, the radar in the Czech Republic, are designed to deal with an eventual Iranian threat. So the logical link is that if that threat can be reduced or eliminated, then the urgency or the need for the ballistic missile defense in Central Europe, at least in terms of its purposes as we identify them, diminish as well or disappear. And so that's a logical linkage. Others in the past, very concerned about the Iranian program and trying to find ways by which the Russians can be induced to join the European countries and the U.S. and the Security Council in putting pressure on Russia, have said we ought to offer many, many other things. We ought to, for example, retreat from the speed with which we want to accelerate Ukraine and Georgia's entry into NATO, or we ought to give up on some other issue that's of concern to the Russians, pay them off, if you will, if they will join us in tougher sanctions on Iran. I call those ideas apples and oranges exchanges, and I don't think they make sense. I don't think they're the right thing to do in terms of those aspects of U.S. foreign policy, and frankly, I don't think they'd work in inducing the Russians to join others in tightening sanctions on Iran. The logical linkage is technically linked, which is ballistic missile defense to Iran. Having said that, two things. One, I don't think the Russians, because President Medvedev has already been clear, are interested in a formal process by which they agree to steps they'll take in pressuring Iran, and we agree to specific things we'll do in order to back away from the missile system. They don't want to get involved with that kind of thing. And the Obama administration has said they're not looking for that kind of quid pro quo. They're simply saying that if all of us pull together in a way where that leads the Iranians to move away from their progress toward nuclear weapons, then the urgency of the need for the ballistic missile defense will diminish. But it doesn't have to be a deal that's formally worked out where the Russians make explicit commitments. So that is the first point of refinement of the news as you're reading it in the press. The second is that even if all of that takes place, even if the Russians say, yes, this is a good idea, yes, I think we ought to pull together in trying to dissuade the Iranians from moving forward with their enrichment program for uranium and then building the nuclear weapon, it's not clear that the deal that's being offered to Iran can be made acceptable, even if the Russians and the three European countries most involved in the United States really are pulling together. So I'm not persuaded that even if what Obama is putting to Moscow comes about, that it's going to achieve success.
And why not? I mean, what is Iran's position on that?
I think in the end we're going to have to accept the fact that Iran will have what's called full fuel cycle capabilities. That is, they'll be able to develop a complete fuel cycle for their domestic uranium production, but we're going to have to find a way to internationalize the fuel processing so that the fuel is supplied from outside, and after it's used, that the spent fuel is returned for reprocessing rather than allowing them to enrich it, and that it be done under the safeguards of the International Atomic Energy Association or entity. And that probably means along the way, since I believe, given the number of countries that will be developing domestic nuclear power in the context of today's energy shortages and emergencies, that as we move forward with an international system for controlling nuclear fuel that denies countries that have these facilities the ability to enrich it to weapons-grade material, that maybe Iran would be one of those regional processing centers somewhere down the road when they've learned how to do this in a way that's safe and that's under international safeguards, that guarantees that they're not able to, as I've said, enrich uranium to a level that they can use for making a nuclear weapon. That's not the system, that's not the plan or the proposal that's on the table today, and I doubt that no matter what the pressure is from the outside community, even with Russian wholehearted support, that the current proposal before Tehran is going to fly. I don't think it's going to work. So I think we're going to have to somewhere along the line find a different way to skin this cat.
We're talking to Professor Robert Legfold. So before we move off this topic, just explain to our audience, what is missile defense? What are we even talking about?
It's in this case, a ground-based system with missiles that's intended to shoot a bullet in order to hit a bullet. That is, it's a system that is designed to, when launched at some point in the flight of an Iranian missile, and the question will be what kind of a range Iran will have. They are still not at a point where they have a missile that can reach Europe, let alone North America. But as they move in that direction, this system is designed as a first stage in being able to hit that missile before it's able to deliver a nuclear weapon on a European target. And presumably it would strike that missile somewhere. In fact, this is a concern for Russia. If the system really worked, it would be striking that missile over Russian territory. But it's designed essentially, as I've said, as a bullet being fired to hit a bullet.
And as we've discussed on this program and many programs before, designing an extremely expensive bullet to hit a bullet is a shaky proposition, at least.
It is.
I mean,
that's been an important part of the Obama administration's view of this system. And a view that was articulated by candidate Obama when he was running for the presidency. That is, his position on this has been that, quite apart from Russia's feelings about it and objections to it, his own view of it is, A, that we shouldn't do it, or at least we should raise questions about it, as long as the need for it is not yet proven, that is, whatever kind of capability Iran will have. But secondly, that it be proven to be effective, technically effective, and cost-effective as a way of dealing with the threat. And that's a position that he has taken more broadly in terms of what's called national missile defense, because this limited facility in Poland and the Czech Republic is part of something that's called the Global Missile Defense System, of which there may be parts at some point planned for Taiwan or elsewhere to deal with what we regard as rogue states that are moving in the direction of nuclear weapons. But in terms of defending the North American mainland, including the United States, we are beginning to develop missile facilities in Alaska and potentially elsewhere for a more extensive system that would defend the United States. And that will be a very costly proposition, especially when it's not yet proven effective. And there are a number of technicians, of which I am certainly not one, but many technicians in this field who believe that it's very unlikely that we'll ever be able to create a system that is a foolproof umbrella that'll protect us from missile attack. The Obama position from the beginning has been not just with respect to the Polish and the Czech site, but with respect to the entire idea, it has to be cost-effective. It has to be technologically sound.
Let's move to another question, which is the issue that Russia is the number three emitter of greenhouse gases after the United States and China. How are they addressing climate change, both internationally and domestically?
The point that you just make, I think, is an important one, because it underscores why the United States needs to engage Russia and work with Russia rather than isolate it or engage in a new Cold War with Russia, because beyond the question of managing nuclear weapons and nonproliferation in the Iranian case, beyond the question of energy supply, the Russians, as I've said, having the world's largest gas reserves and they're a critical supplier to Europe, there are a number of other areas where we have stakes in a more constructive and positive relationship, and one of those is climate change. Because Russia, after the United States and China, the United States and China are the worst or the largest emitters of greenhouse gases, but then comes the Russians. So if we really are going to make progress in what will be the follow-on to Kyoto, the UN Conference on Climate Change in Copenhagen at the end of this year, we're going to need cooperation among the United States, Russia, and China. To answer your question directly, the Russians, for the moment, because although they are a large greenhouse gas emitter, in terms of the quotas that have been set up for nations, in terms of carbon emissions, because the Russian economy is underdeveloped and now because it's sinking into a deep economic recession, they in fact have some ceiling or if you will, some room in terms of their carbon quotas. And one of the things that has been going on in the sphere under Kyoto and other things are trading these quotas when they've got a little bit of room where they haven't expanded them yet. But so it means that Russia, under most of the norms that are being set right now, are actually under the quotas that they would be allowed. But because they are very energy inefficient, three times as inefficient in terms of units of energy per unit of GDP or gross domestic product, because they're three times as inefficient as the countries in the European Union, for example. Here's a country with the application of technology could make real headway in limiting greenhouse gases. But it's also very important that they're in a cooperative mood working with us and the Chinese if the three greatest offenders are to work together in order to make some real progress on climate change by the end of the year.
So in one breath, we talk about addressing climate change, and then in the next breath, we talk about the new fossil fuel resources in the Arctic, which have opened up by the melting caused by climate change itself, and the development of resources in the Caspian Sea, all of which would lead to a lot more climate change. How do you envision a rational international policy on this?
It's a good question, and there's no doubt that in the near term, countries are not going to be able to move away from fossil fuel. They're not going to be able to supply most of their energy needs, whether they're the industrialized economies or the developing economies, with biofuels or with environmentally friendly sources, solar and otherwise. In fact, for the foreseeable future, the major supply of energy is going to be gas, even more important than oil for the somewhat longer term. And in that context, we've got really two issues, both of which again concern Russia, both of which are important to U.S.-Russian relations. One is, to the extent that fossil fuels, oil and gas in particular, remain an important energy source and one that moves across borders so that suppliers in one area can provide the energy source to consumers that don't have adequate supplies, this needs to be done in a way that doesn't increase international tension or lead to rivalry or competition. It needs to be done in ways that are cooperative so that everybody can profit from it. But simultaneously, there needs to be a process by which energy consumers and developing economies, as we go forward with growth in the 21st century, begin moving away from fossil fuels. One of the great offenders in the near term, and this is why China is so important, of course, is coal. And there is no, even though the technologies are designed to create what is called clean coal, there is no such thing as clean coal. The Chinese are giant users of coal, the Russians less so in this area. So the first step in terms of moving away from fossil fuels is to get some control over the consumption of coal. Then one wants to work on the remainder of the hydrocarbons. But we're really talking about two different processes, both of which require cooperation between the United States and Russia. And you're quite right that in terms of the environment, the effects are contradictory.
Give us, if this is possible to do briefly, a little walk through the conflicts in Georgia. Georgia became an independent state, a nation, after the breakup of the Soviet Union. It's culturally and nationally distinct from Russia. What happened there? Why does the U.S. care?
When the Soviet Union came apart, because it had been fashioned not only of these independent, these republics with separate identities, cultural, linguistic, and otherwise, Georgia, Armenia, Azerbaijan, and the Caucasus, the Central Asian republics, five of them, Ukraine, Belarus, Moldova, and the West. But each of these Soviet republics, they were called Union republics, in turn had parts within them that were made up of minority peoples, although they may have been a majority within those locales. And when the Soviet Union broke up, a number of these regions that had been comfortable when they were embedded in republics that in turn were embedded within the Soviet Union began worrying about the way they'd be repressed in new independent republican, new independent states. So you had separatist struggles, that is, these territories trying to separate themselves from what would now be new independent states in several areas, a region in Moldova called Transnistria, two regions in Georgia, one South Ossetia, which is made up with nearly a majority of people that are more closely related to their North Ossetian kinspeople across the border in the Russian Federation, and Abkhazia, which has a, has several nationalities, Greek, Armenian, Abkhaz themselves, and Georgians. That led to wars, literally civil wars, in both Moldova and in Georgia in the early 1990s. Peace was made. The Russians played a role in it, but the Georgians always believed the Russians had been part of the problem, had fed the original conflict, and then had served as a barrier to achieving any kind of reconciliation or reincorporation of these so-called separatist territories back into what they see as the motherland. And there's been back and forth on this issue, plus a number of others that had created tension between Russia and Georgia, including Russian bases that were left or, in fact, recreated in Georgia in the 1990s, questions of Georgian workers and visas, Georgian workers that were in Russia as guest workers, sending remittances back to Georgia, how they were treated and what the visa issue was on it, a whole series of issues that continued to roil the relationship and create tensions. The new Georgian leadership after the Rose Revolution in 2003 has been particularly eager to make progress on the so-called frozen conflicts and move the two separatist territories back into Georgia. And in the context of a series of other events that I won't go into the detail of, including what happened in Kosovo with unilaterally declared independence and the Russian reaction to that as it played out in the case of Abkhazia and South Ossetia, you had rising tensions through the spring of 2008 until in August of this year, the Georgian leadership took the decision to clarify matters if they could militarily by launching a major attack in response to a series of incidents, violent incidents, in South Ossetia by attacking the capital. The Russians responded in a big way, not only by clearing South Ossetia of Georgian military forces, but invading Georgia itself, and then seizing the territories, now recognizing both South Ossetia and Abkhazia as independent. Only Russia and, in the international community, Russia and Nicaragua have done that, but in the meantime, the relationship has of course been enormously damaged by the war itself. That is the relationship between Russia and Georgia.
And so the United States is concerned about this because?
The U.S. has been concerned for a variety of reasons. In the mid-1990s, we were concerned, A, because all along the line we believe that the new states in the former Soviet Union should be independent, have a right to develop independently, and one would hope in a democratic direction with a modern market-based economy and integrated in the international economy. So Georgia was one of a number of states in that category. Add to that, then, by the mid-1990s, around 1995, growing U.S. interest in making sure that large quantities of oil and gas in the Caspian Sea region could reach Europe and the outside world, and Georgia is one of the transit countries for a key pipeline that runs in that area. That, in turn, could not be made secure unless there was some kind of progress in dealing with these so-called frozen conflicts that threatened to blow up at any moment. And then after 2003 and the Rose Revolution, Georgia was seen as one of the great hopes for a kind of new democratic wave that you would have as a result of this revolution, because those who made that revolution were seen as Western-oriented and democratic, a success for a Bush administration that 6 months before had launched a war in Iraq in order to bring democracy into that part of the world, an experiment that was not working very well by the fall of 2003. The Georgians became strong supporters of the Bush administration, even sent volunteers or military units to Georgia. And the Bush administration gave very strong support to the leadership of Georgia, those who made the Rose Revolution, the key figure being Mikhail Saakashvili, the Georgian president. 2005, President Bush went to Georgia. He was warmly received at a time when he would not have received a warm reception in many countries, made a major speech in Georgia. They named the highway from the airport into the center of the city after him. The road is named the Bush Highway. So you've got a series of things that have been layered one on the other that have increased the U.S. stakes in this relationship over the last 15 years.
We're talking to Professor Robert Legvold. So there are issues of the kind that we've been talking about for the last half an hour, and there are relationships. And as we know from our personal relationships, there can be tension that builds up so that you can't even talk about issues anymore because people are emotional and they're suspicious and they've got baggage from past things that have happened. What was the tenor of the relationship between Russia and the last few American presidencies? And how do you see Obama and his administration, including Hillary Clinton, in terms of being able to make calm and rational and happy relationships with Russia?
That's a subtle and accurate allusion that you make, that is, comparison to individual relationships, because in many ways that does characterize what's happened in the relationship. As I've said, at the outset of Russian independence after the collapse of the Soviet Union, the relationship was very warm. Boris Yeltsin, the president of Russia, and his foreign minister, Andrei Kozarev, spoke about a strategic alliance of democratic states from Vancouver to Vladivostok. They talked about the possibility that Russia might even come into NATO, even though that was not seriously considered on the two sides. It looked as though the Russians wanted to associate themselves very closely with the Western camp, consider themselves to be a part of it. And things have, with ups and downs, gone downhill since. There was, for a period of time, especially in 2001, a close personal relationship between George W. Bush and Yeltsin's successor, Vladimir Putin. After they had their initial meeting, I think the two men identified with one another. That's not unimportant. That can affect a relationship. But in the end, it wasn't enough to sustain the relationship as it began going downhill by 2003. And the Russians have become, as you suggested with your comparison, emotional and bitter, not merely discontent with specifics in particular areas where they see their interests threatened, whether it's on the question of Georgia and Ukraine and NATO, or whether it is the U.S. role and the role of non-governmental organizations and some of Russia's neighbors or even within Russia, or other issues that have divided us. There's an emotional overtone to it. I think part of that has been driven by Russian frustration at being down, loss of empire, degraded in their own mind because they think of themselves as a major power. Treated like a junior partner who needed to take marching orders if that junior partner were to cooperate with the West. At least that was their view of it. Not consulted until after the fact. Again, that's their view on anything, on many things, including policy in the Balkans or even on how you deal with Iran or these other issues. And that has doubtless exaggerated in the way in which they've thought of U.S. policy, beginning with the Clinton administration and then carrying through the Bush administration, doubtless been exaggerated, but hence it has built the emotional side of it until Putin on several occasions has lashed out in attacking the United States for its unilateralism and its its excessive militarization and the trouble that it's created in international politics. He's been far more critical and outspoken over the last 4 or 5 years than even our allies who are critical of U.S. policy in Iraq. And that's where they were when the election was held. They now have guarded hopes that things can change. And one of the reasons for that is because it's clear that the Obama administration is trying to change the tone and test the waters to see what may be possible in beginning to turn this relationship around and in a more more productive or more constructive direction. It's not clear it can be done because there are issues where we are divided, and as you imply, there is an enormously negative emotional incrustation around it at the moment. But at this juncture, it looks as though there's an attempt. There certainly is an attempt on the part of the new administration to begin changing things, and it looks as though from the reactions, including the reaction of the Russian foreign minister, Sergei Lavrov, in his meeting with our Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, last weekend, that the Russians are at least entertaining the idea that things can again begin to improve.
Robert Leichvold is Professor Emeritus at Columbia University and Project Director at the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, and he will be here in Santa Fe on Saturday, March 14th from 3 to 5 in the afternoon at the Forum at the College of Santa Fe, and his lecture is called Russia's New International Posture, sponsored by the Santa Fe Council on International Relations. Professor Leichvold, thanks so much for being with us here on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
My pleasure. Good luck.
We're going to take a little break right now. We'll be back in a moment. Please stay tuned to KSFR.